Continuing our reading of Thomas Watson's A Body of Divinity, under the second point, God and His Creation, questions 3 and 4, The Knowledge of God, part 2. The Lord is a God of knowledge, and by Him actions are weighed, 1 Samuel 2:3. Glorious things are spoken of God. He transcends our thoughts and the praises of angels. God's glory lies chiefly in His attributes, which are the several beams by which the divine nature shines forth. Among other of His orient excellencies, this is not the least. The Lord is a God of knowledge, or, as the Hebrew word is, a God of knowledges. Through the bright mirror of His own essence, He has a full idea and cognizance of all things. The world is to Him a transparent body. He makes a heart anatomy, Revelation 2:23, I am He which searcheth the reins and the heart. The clouds are no canopy, the night is no curtain to draw between us and His sight, Psalm 139:12, the darkness hideth not from Thee. There is not a word we whisper, but God hears it, Psalm 139:4, there is not a word in my tongue, but Lord, O Lord, Thou knowest it altogether. There is not the most subtle thought that comes into our mind, but God perceives it. Isaiah 66:18, I know their thoughts. Thoughts speak as loud in God's ears as words do in ours. All our actions, though never so subtly contrived and secretly conveyed, are visible to the eye of omniscience. Isaiah 66:18, I know their works. Achan hid the Babylonish garment in the earth, but God brought it to light, Joshua 7:21. Minerva was drawn in such curious colors and so lively penciled, that which way soever one turned, Minerva's eyes were upon him. So, which way soever we turn ourselves, God's eye is upon us, Job 37:16. Dost thou know the balancing of the clouds, the wondrous works of Him that is perfect in knowledge? God knows whatever is knowable. He knows future contingencies. He foretold Israel's coming out of Babylon, and the virgins conceiving. By this the Lord proves the truth of His Godhead against all idols. Isaiah 41:23. Show the things that are to come hereafter, that we may know ye are gods. The perfection of God's knowledge is primary. He is the original, the pattern and prototype of all knowledge. Others borrow their knowledge of Him. The angels light their lamps at this glorious sun. God's knowledge is pure. He is not contaminated with the object. Though God knows sin, yet it is to hate and punish it. No evil can mix or incorporate with His knowledge, any more than the sun can be defied with the vapors which arise from the earth. God's knowledge is facile. It is without any difficulty. We study and search for knowledge, Proverbs 2:4, if thou seekest for her as for silver. The lamp of God's knowledge is so infinitely bright that all things are intelligible to Him. God's knowledge is infallible. There is no mistake in His knowledge. Human knowledge is subject to error. A physician may mistake the cause of a disease, but God's knowledge is unerring. He can neither deceive nor be deceived. He cannot deceive because He is truth, nor be deceived because He is wisdom. God's knowledge is instantaneous. Our knowledge is successive, one thing after another. We argue from the effect to the cause. God knows things past, present, and to come at once. They are all before Him in one entire prospect. God's knowledge is retentive. He never loses any of His knowledge. He remembers as well as understands. Many things elapse out of our minds, but God's knowledge is eternized. Things transacted 1,000 years ago are as fresh to Him as if they were done in the last minute. Thus He is perfect in knowledge. But you ask, is it not said, Genesis 18:21, I will go down and see whether they have done according to the cry which has come up unto me, and I will know? It could not be that God was ignorant, because there is mention made of a cry, but the Lord speaks there after the manner of a judge, who will first examine the cause before he passes sentence. When he is upon a work of justice, he is not in a riot, as if he did not care where he hits, but he goes straight against offenders. He lays judgment to the line and righteousness to the plummet, Isaiah 28:17. But Hosea 13:12 says, the iniquity of Ephraim is bound up, his sin is hid. Not that his sin is hid from God, but his sin is hid, that is, it is recorded. It is laid up against a day of reckoning. That this is the meaning is clear by the foregoing words, his iniquity is bound up. as the clerk of the Assizes binds up the indictments of malefactors in a bundle, and at the Assizes brings out the indictments and reads them in court, so God binds up men's sins in a bundle. And at the day of judgment this bundle shall be opened, and all their sins brought to light before men and angels. God is infinite in knowledge. He cannot but be so, for he who gives being to things must needs have a clear inspection of them. Psalm 94:9. He that planted the ear, shall he not hear? He that formed the eye, shall he not see? He who makes a watch or engine knows all the workmanship in it. God that made the heart knows all its movements. He is full of eyes, like Ezekiel's wheels. And as Austin says, all eye. It ought to be so, for he is to be judge of all the world, Genesis 18:25. There are so many causes to be brought before him, and so many persons to be tried, that he must have a perfect knowledge, or he could not do justice. An ordinary judge cannot proceed without a jury. The jury must search the cause and give in the verdict. But God can judge without a jury. He knows all things in and of himself, and needs no witnesses to inform him. A judge judges only matters of fact, but God judges the heart. He not only judges wicked actions, but wicked designs. He sees the treason of the heart and punishes it. Use 1. Is God infinite in knowledge? He is light, and in him there is no darkness. Then how unlike are they to God, who are darkness, and in whom is no light, who are destitute of knowledge, such as the Indians who never heard of God? And are there not many among us who are no better than baptized heathens, who need to seek the first principles of the oracles of God? It is sad that after the sun of the gospel has shined so long in our horizon, to this day the veil should be upon their heart. Such as are enveloped in ignorance cannot give God a reasonable service, Romans 12:1. Ignorance is the nurse of impiety. The schoolmen say every sin is founded upon ignorance. Jeremiah 9:3. They proceed from evil to evil, and know not me, saith the Lord. Where ignorance reigns in the understanding, lust rages in the affections. Proverbs 19:2. That the mind be without knowledge, it is not good. Such have neither faith nor fear. No faith, for knowledge carries the torch before faith. Psalm 9:10. They that know thy name shall put their trust in thee. A man can no more believe without knowledge than the eye can see without light. He can have no fear of God, for how can they fear him whom they do not know? The covering of Haman's face was a sad presage of his death. When people's minds are covered with ignorance, it is a covering of the face that is a fatal forerunner of destruction. Use 2. If God be a God of knowledge, then see the folly of hypocrisy. Hypocrites do not actually do good, they merely make a show of it, says Melanchthon. They carry it fair with men, but care not how bad their hearts are. They live in secret sin. Psalm 73:11. They say, how doth God know? Psalm 10:11. God hath forgotten. He hideth his face. He will never see it. But Psalm 147:5, his understanding is infinite. He has a window to look into men's hearts. He has a key for the heart. He beholds all the sinful workings of men's spirits. As in a glass hive we can see the bees working in their combs, Matthew 6:4. He sees in secret. As a merchant enters debts in his book, so God has his day book in which he enters every sin. Jeroboam's wife disguised herself that the prophet should not know her, but he discerned her. 1 Kings 14:6. Why feignest thou thyself to be another? The hypocrite thinks to prevaricate and juggle with God, but God will unmask him. Ecclesiastes 12:14. God shall bring every work into judgment with every secret thing. Jeremiah 29:13. They have committed villainy in Israel. Even I know, and am a witness, saith the Lord. Aha! But the hypocrite hopes he shall color over his sin, and make it look very specious. Absalom masks over his treason with the pretense of a religious vow. Judas dissembles his envy at Christ and his covetousness with a pretense of charity to the poor. John 12:5. Jehu makes religion a stirrup to his ambitious design, 2 Kings 10:16, but God sees through these fig leaves. You may see a jade under his gilt trappings, Jeremiah 16:17. Their iniquities are not hid from mine eyes. He that hath an eye to see will find a hand to punish. Use 3. Is God so infinite in knowledge? Then we should always feel as under his omniscient eye. Hence we ought to live as if always in full view, says Seneca. Let us set David's prospect before our eye. Psalm 16:8, I have set the Lord always before me. Seneca counseled Lucilius that whatever he was doing, he should imagine some of the Roman worthies stood before him, and then he would do nothing dishonorable. The consideration of God's omniscience would be preventive of much sin. The eye of man will restrain from sin, and will not God's eyes much more? Esther 7:8, then said the king, will he force the queen also before me? Will we sin when our judge looks on? Would men speak so vainly if they considered God overheard them? Latimer took heed to every word in his examination when he heard the pen go behind the hanging. So, what care would persons have of their words if they remembered God heard and the pen is going on in heaven? Would men go after strange flesh if they believed God was a spectator of their wickedness and would make them do penance in hell for it? Would they defraud in their dealings and use false weights if they thought God saw them, and for making their weights lighter would make their damnation heavier? Viewing ourselves as under the eye of God's omniscience would cause reverence in worship of God. God sees the frame and carriage of our hearts when we come before him. How would this call in our straggling thoughts? How would it animate and spirit duty? It would make us put fire to the incense. Acts 26:7, the tribes instantly served God day and night with the utmost zeal and intenseness of spirit. To think God is in this place would add wings to prayer and oil to the flame of our devotion. Use 4. Is God's knowledge infinite? Study sincerity. Be what you seem. 1 Samuel 16:7, the Lord looketh upon the heart. Men judge the heart by the actions, God judges the actions by the heart. If the heart be sincere, God will see the faith and bear with the failing. Asa had his blemishes, but his heart was right with God, 2 Chronicles 15:17. God saw his sincerity and pardoned his infirmity. Sincerity in a Christian is like chastity in a wife, which excuses many failings. Sincerity makes our duties acceptable, like musk among linen that perfumes it. As Jehu said to Jehonadab, 2 Kings 10:15, is thy heart right with me? And he said, it is. If it be, said he, give me thy hand. And he took him up into the chariot. So if God sees our heart is right, that we love him and design his glory, now, says he, give me your prayers and tears. Now you shall come up with me into the chariot of glory. Sincerity makes our services to be golden, and God will not cast away the gold, though it may want some weight. Is God omniscient and his eye chiefly upon the heart? Wear the girdle of truth about you, and never leave it off. Use 5. Is God a God of infinite knowledge? Then there is comfort, firstly, to the saints in particular, secondly, to the church in general. Firstly, to the saints in particular, in case of private devotion. Christian, thou settest hours apart for God, thy thoughts run upon him as thy treasure. God takes notice of every good thought. Malachi 3:16, he had a book of remembrance written for them that thought upon his name. Thou enterest into thy closet and prayest to thy Father in secret. He hears every sigh and groan. Psalm 38:9, my groaning is not hid from thee. Thou waterest the seed of thy prayer with tears. God bottles every tear. Psalm 56:8, put thou my tears into thy bottle. When the secrets of all hearts shall be opened, God will make an honorable mention of the zeal and devotion of his people, and he himself will be the herald of their praises. 1 Corinthians 4:5, then shall every man have praise of God. The infiniteness of God's knowledge is a comfort, in case the saints have not a clear knowledge of themselves. They find so much corruption that they judge they have no grace. Genesis 25:22, if it be so, why am I thus? If I have grace, why is my heart in so dead and earthy a frame? Oh, remember, God is of infinite knowledge. He can spy grace where thou canst not. He can see grace hid under corruption as the stars may be hid under a cloud. God can see that holiness in thee which thou canst not discern in thyself. He can spy the flower of grace in thee, though overtopped with weeds, 1 Kings 14:13, because there is in him some good thing. God sees some good thing in his people when they can see no good in themselves, and though they judge themselves, he will give them an absolution. It is comfort in respect of personal injuries. It is the saint's lot to suffer. The head being crowned with thorns, the feet must not tread upon roses. If saints find a real purgatory, it is in this life. But this is their comfort, that God sees what is wrong that is done to them. The apple of his eye is touched, and is he not sensible of it? Paul was scourged by cruel hands, 2 Corinthians 11:25. Thrice was I beaten with rods, as if you should see a scullion whip the king's son. God beholds it, Exodus 3:7. I know their sorrows. The wicked make wounds in the backs of the saints, and then pour in vinegar. But God writes down their cruelty. Believers are a part of Christ's mystical body, and for every drop of a saint's blood spilt, God puts a drop of wrath in his vial. Secondly, comfort to the church of God in general. If God be a God of knowledge, he sees all the plots of the enemies against Zion, and can make them prove abortive. The wicked are subtle, having borrowed their skill from the old serpent. They dig deep to hide their counsels from God, but he sees them, and can easily counterwork them. The dragon is described with 7 heads in Revelation 12:3 to show how he plots against the church, but God is described with 7 eyes in Zechariah 3:9 to show that he sees all the plots and stratagems of the enemies, and when they deal proudly, he can be above them. Come, says Pharaoh, let us deal wisely, Exodus 1:10, but he never played the fool more than when he thought to deal wisely. Exodus 14:24, in the morning watch the Lord looked to the host of the Egyptians by the pillar of fire and troubled the host. How may this, like sap in the vine, comfort the church of God in her militant state? The Lord has an eye in all the counsels and combinations of the enemy. He sees them in their train and can blow them up in their own mind. Part 3. The eternity of God. The next attribute is God is eternal. Psalm 90, verse 2, from everlasting to everlasting, thou art God. The schoolmen try to explain the notion of eternity. There is a threefold being. First, such as had a beginning and shall have an end, as all sensitive creatures, the beasts, fowls, fishes, which at death are destroyed and returned to dust, their being ends with their life. Second, such as had a beginning but shall have no end, as angels and the souls of men, which are eternal, they abide forever. Third, such as is without beginning and without ending, and that is proper only to God. He is from everlasting to everlasting. This is God's title, a jewel in his crown. He is called the King Eternal, 1 Timothy 1:17. Jehovah is a word that properly sets forth God's eternity, a word so dreadful that the Jews trembled to name or read it, and used Adonai, the Lord, in its place. Jehovah contains in it time past, present, and to come, Revelation 1:8, which is, and which was, and which is to come, interprets the word Jehovah, which is. He subsists of himself, having a pure and independent being, which was. God only was before time. There is no searching into the records of eternity. Which is to come? His kingdom has no end. His crown has no successors. Hebrews 1:8. Thy throne, O God, is forever and ever. The doubling of the word ratifies the certainty of it, as the doubling of Pharaoh's dream. I shall prove that God only could be eternal without beginning. Angels could not, they are but creatures, though spirits, they were made, and therefore their beginning may be known. Angels' antiquity may be searched into. If you ask, when were angels created, some think before the world was, but not so, for what was before time was eternal. The first origin of angels reaches no higher than the beginning of the world. It is thought by the learned that the angels were made on the day on which the heavens were made. Job 38:7, when the morning stars sang together, and all the sons of God shouted for joy. St. Jerome, Gregory, and the Venerable Bede understand it, that when God laid the foundation stone of the world, the angels being then created sang anthems of joy and praise. It is proper to God only to be eternal, without beginning. He is Alpha and Omega, the first and the last, Revelation 1:8. No creature can write itself Alpha. That is only a flower of the crown of heaven, Exodus 3:14. I am that I am. That is, he who exists from eternity and to eternity. Use 1. Here is thunder and lightning to the wicked. God is eternal, therefore the torments of the wicked are eternal. God lives forever, and as long as God lives, he will be punishing the damned. This should be as the handwriting upon the wall. It should make their joints to be loosed. Daniel 5:6. The sinner takes liberty to sin. He breaks God's laws like a wild beast that breaks over the hedge and leaps into forbidden pasture. He sins with greediness as if he thought he could not sin fast enough. Ephesians 4:19. But remember, one of God's names is eternal. And as long as God is eternal, he has time enough to reckon with all his enemies. To make sinners tremble, let them think of these three things. The torments of the damned are without intermission, without mixture, and eternal. First, without intermission, their pains shall be acute and sharp and no relaxation. The fire shall not be slackened or abated. Revelation 14:11. They have no rest day nor night, like one that has his joints stretched continually on the rack and has no ease. The wrath of God is compared to a stream of brimstone, Isaiah 30:33. Why to a stream? Because a stream runs without intermission, so God's wrath runs like a stream and pours out without intermission. In the pains of this life, there is some abatement and intermission. The fever abates. After a fit of the stone, the patient has some ease, but the pains of hell are intense and violent. The damned soul never says, I am now more at ease. Second, without mixture. Hell is a place of pure justice. In this life, God in anger remembers mercy. He mixes compassion with suffering. Deuteronomy 33:25. Asher's shoe was of iron, but his foot was dipped in oil. Affliction is the iron shoe, but mercy is mixed with it. The foot is dipped in oil. But the torments of the damned have no mixture. Revelation 14:10. They shall drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out without mixture. No mixture of mercy. How is the cup of wrath said to be full of mixture? Psalm 75:8. For in the hand of the Lord there is a cup, and the wine is red, it is full of mixture, and he poureth out of the same, but the dregs thereof all the wicked of the earth shall wring them out and drink them. Yet in the Revelation it is said to be without mixture. It is full of mixture, that is, it is full of all the ingredients that may make it bitter. The worm, the fire, the curse of God, all these are bitter ingredients. It is a cup mixed, yet it is without mixture. There shall be nothing to afford the least comfort, no mixture of mercy, and so without mixture. In the sacrifice of jealousy, Numbers 5:15, no oil was put to it. So in the torments of the damned, there is no oil of mercy to abate their sufferings. Third, without cessation, eternal. The pleasures of sin are but for a season, but the torments of the wicked are forever and ever. Sinners have a short feast, but a long reckoning. Origen erroneously thought that after 1,000 years the damned should be released out of their misery. But the worm, the fire, the prison are all eternal. Revelation 14:11, the smoke of their torment ascendeth forever and ever. The torments of hell keep on punishing. They never end. Prosper. Eternity is a sea without bottom and banks. After millions of years, there is not 1 minute in eternity wasted, and the damned must be ever burning but never consuming, always dying but never dead. Revelation 9:6. They shall seek death but shall not find it. The fire of hell is such as multitudes of tears will not quench it. Length of time will not finish it. The vial of God's wrath will be always dropping upon a sinner. As long as God is eternal, he lives to be avenged upon the wicked. O eternity, eternity, who can fathom it? Mariners have their plummets to measure the depths of the sea, but what line or plummet shall we use to fathom the depth of eternity? The breath of the Lord kindles the eternal, infernal lake, Isaiah 30:33, and where shall we have engines or buckets to quench that fire? O eternity, if all the body of the earth and sea were turned to sand, and all the air up to the starry heaven were nothing but sand, and a little bird should come every 1,000 years, and fetch away in her bill but the 1/10th part of a grain of all that heap of sand, what numberless years would be spent before that vast heap of sand would be fetched away? Yet if at the end of all that time the sinner might come out of hell, there would be some hope. But that word ever breaks the heart. The smoke of their torment ascendeth up forever and ever. What a terror is this to the wicked, enough to put them into a cold sweat, to think, as long as God is eternal, he lives forever to be avenged upon them. Here the question may be asked, why should sin that is committed in a short time be punished eternally? We must hold with Augustine that God's judgments on the wicked may be secret, but never unjust. The reason why sin committed in a short time is eternally punished is because every sin is committed against an infinite essence, and no less than eternity of punishment can satisfy. Why is treason punished with confiscation and death? But because it is against the king's person, which is sacred. Much more that offense which is against God's crown and dignity is of a heinous and infinite nature, and cannot be satisfied with less than eternal punishment. Use, too, of comfort to the godly. God is eternal, therefore he lives forever to reward the godly, Romans 2:7, to them who seek for glory and honor eternal life. The people of God here are in a suffering condition, Acts 20:23, bonds and afflictions abide me. The wicked are clad in purple and fare deliciously while the godly suffer. Goats climb upon high mountains while Christ's sheep are in the valley of slaughter. But here is the comfort, God is eternal, and he has appointed eternal recompenses for the saints. In heaven are fresh delights, sweetness without surfeit, and that which is the crown and zenith of heaven's happiness is that it is eternal. 1 John 3:15. Were there but the least suspicion that this glory must cease, it would much eclipse, yea, embitter it, but it is eternal. What angel can span eternity? 2 Corinthians 4:17, an eternal weight of glory. The saints shall bathe themselves in the rivers of divine pleasure, and these rivers can never be dried up. Psalm 16:11, at thy right hand are pleasures forevermore. This is the Elah, the highest strain in the apostles' rhetoric, 1 Thessalonians 4:17, ever with the Lord. There is peace without trouble, ease without pain, glory without end, ever with the Lord. Let this comfort the saints in all their troubles. Their sufferings are but short, but their reward is eternal. Eternity makes heaven to be heaven. It is the diamond in the ring. O blessed day that shall have no night. The sunlight of glory shall rise upon the soul and never set. O blessed spring that shall have no autumn or fall of the leaf. The Roman emperors have 3 crowns set upon their heads, the first of iron, the second of silver, the third of gold. So the Lord sets 3 crowns on his children, grace, comfort, and glory, and this crown is eternal. 1 Peter 5:4, ye shall receive a crown of glory that fadeth not away. The wicked have a never-dying worm, and the godly a never-fading crown. Oh, how should this be a spur to virtue? How willing should we be to work for God? Though we had nothing here, God has time enough to reward his people. The crown of eternity shall be set upon their head. Use 3 of exhortation. Study eternity. Our thoughts should chiefly run upon eternity. We all wish for the present, something that may delight the senses. If we could have lived, as Augustine says, from the infancy of the world to the world's old age, what were this? What is time measured with eternity? As the earth is but a small point to the heaven, so time is but, nay, scarce a minute to eternity. And then, what is this poor life which crumbles away so fast? Oh, think of eternity! Brethren, we are every day traveling to eternity, and whether we wake or sleep, we are going our journey. Some of us are upon the borders of eternity. Oh, study the shortness of life and length of eternity. More particularly, think of God's eternity and the soul's eternity. Think of God's eternity. He is the Ancient of Days who was before all time. There is a figurative description of God in Daniel 7:9. The Ancient of Days did sit, whose garment was white as snow, and the hair of his head like pure wool. His white garment wherewith he was clothed signified his majesty, his hair like the pure wool, his holiness, and the Ancient of Days his eternity. The thought of God's eternity should make us have high, adoring thoughts of God. We are apt to have mean, irreverent thoughts of him. Psalm 50, verse 21, "Thou thoughtest I was such an one as thyself, weak and mortal." But if we would think of God's eternity when all our power ceases, he is King eternal. His crown flourishes forever. He can make us happy or miserable forever. This would make us have adoring thoughts of God. Revelation 4:10, "The 24 elders fall down before him that sat upon the throne, and worship him that liveth forever and ever, and cast their crowns before the throne." The saints fall down to signify by that humble posture that they are not worthy to sit in God's presence. They fall down and they worship him that liveth forever and ever. They do, as it were, kiss his feet. They cast their crowns before the throne. They lay all their honor at his feet. Thus they show humble adoration to the eternal essence. Study God's eternity. It will make us adore where we cannot fathom. Think of the soul's eternity. As God is eternal, so he has made us eternal. We are never dying creatures. We are shortly entering upon an eternal state, either of happiness or misery. Have serious thoughts of this. Say, O my soul, which of these two eternities is like to be thy portion? I must shortly depart hence, and whither then shall I go? To which of these eternities, either of glory or misery? A serious meditation of the eternal state we are to pass into would work strongly with us. First, thoughts of eternal torments are a good antidote against sin. Sin tempts with its pleasure, but when we think of eternity, it may cool the intemperate heat of lust. Shall I, for the pleasure of sin for a season, endure eternal pain? Sin, like those locusts, Revelation 9:7, seems to have on its head a crown of gold, but it has in it a tail like a scorpion, verse 10, and a sting in its tail, and this sting can never be plucked out. Shall I venture eternal wrath? Is sin committed so sweet as lying in hell forever is bitter? This thought would make us flee from sin as Moses fled from the serpent. 2. The serious thoughts of eternal happiness would very much take us off from worldly things. Where are these sublunary things to eternity? They're quickly gone. They salute us and take their farewell. But I am to enter upon an everlasting estate. I hope to live with him who is eternal. What is the world to me? To those who stand upon the top of the Alps, the great cities of Campania are a small thing in their eyes. So to him who has his thoughts fixed on his eternal state after this life, all these things seem as nothing in his eye. What is the glory of this world? How poor and contemptible compared with an eternal weight of glory? 3. The serious thoughts of an eternal state, either of happiness or misery, should have a powerful influence upon whatsoever we take in hand. Every work we do promotes either a blessed or a cursed eternity. Every good action sets us a step nearer to an eternity of happiness. Every bad action sets us a step nearer to an eternity of misery. Oh, what influence should those thoughts of eternity have upon our religious duties? It should make us do them with all our might. Duty well performed lifts a Christian higher towards heaven and sets a Christian a step nearer to a blessed eternity. Part 4, the unchangeableness of God. The next attribute is God's unchangeableness. I am Jehovah, I change not, Malachi 3:6. God is unchangeable in his nature, firstly, and secondly, in his decree. Firstly, unchangeable in his nature. First, there is no eclipse of his brightness. Second, no period put to his being. First, no eclipse to his brightness. His essence shines with a fixed luster, with whom is no variableness, neither shadow of turning. James 1:17, thou art the same. Psalm 102, verse 27, all created things are full of vicissitudes. Princes and emperors are subject to mutation. Sesostris, an Egyptian prince, having subdued divers kings in war, made them draw his chariot like horses, as if he intended them to eat grass, as God did King Nebuchadnezzar. The crown has many successors. Kingdoms have their eclipses and convulsions. What is to become of the glory of Athens? The pomp of Troy? Now corn grows where Troy once stood. Though kingdoms have a head of gold, they have feet of clay. The heavens change. As a vesture shalt thou change them, and they shall be changed. Psalm 102:26. The heavens are the most ancient records where God has written his glory with a sunbeam, yet these shall change. Though I do not think they shall be destroyed as to their substance, yet they shall be changed as to their qualities. They shall melt with fervent heat, and so be more refined and purified. 2 Peter 3:12. Thus the heavens shall be changed, but not he who dwells in heaven. With him there is no variableness nor shadow of turning. The best saints have their eclipses and changes. Look upon a Christian in his spiritual estate, and he is full of variation. Though the seed of grace does not die, yet its beauty and activity often wither. A Christian has his anguish, his fits in religion. Sometimes his faith is at a high tide, sometimes low ebb. Sometimes his love flames, and at other times is like fire in the embers. And he has lost his first love. How strong was David's grace at one time! The God of my rock, in him will I trust. 2 Samuel 22:3. At another time he says, I shall one day perish by the hand of Saul. What Christian can say he does not find a change in his graces, that the bow of his faith never unbends, the strings of his viol never slacken? Surely we shall never meet with such Christians till we meet them in heaven. But God is without any shadow of turning. The angels were subject to change. They were created holy, but mutable. The angels which kept not their first estate, Jude 6. These morning stars of heaven were falling stars, but God's glory shines with a fixed brightness. In God there is nothing that looks like a change, for better or worse, not better, because then he were not perfect. Not worse, for then he would cease to be perfect. He is immutably holy, immutably good. There is no shadow of change in him. But when Christ, you ask, who is God, assumed the human nature, there was a change in God. If the divine nature had been converted into the human, or the human into the divine, there had been a change, but they were not so. The human nature was distinct from the divine, therefore there was no change. A cloud over the sun makes no change in the body of the sun, so though the divine nature be covered with the human, it makes no change in the divine nature. Secondly, there is no period put to his being, who only hath immortality. 1 Timothy 6:16. The Godhead cannot die, an infinite essence cannot be changed into finite, but God is infinite. He is eternal, so he is not mortal. To be eternal and mortal is a contradiction. Use 1. See the excellence of the divine nature and its immutability. This is the glory of the Godhead. Mutableness denotes weakness and is not in God, who is the same yesterday and today and forever. Hebrews 13:8. Men are fickle and mutable like Reuben, unstable as water. Genesis 49:4. They are changeable in their principles. If their faces altered as fast as their opinions, we should not know them. Changeable in their resolutions, as the wind that blows in the east presently turns about to the west. They resolve to be virtuous, but quickly repent of their resolutions. Their minds are like a sick man's pulse, which alters every half hour. An apostle compares them to waves of the sea and wandering stars in Jude 13. They are not pillars in God's temple, but reeds. Others are changeable in their friendship. They quickly love and quickly hate. Sometimes they will put you in their bosom, then excommunicate you out of their favor. They change as the chameleon into several colors, but God is immutable. Use 2. See the vanity of the creature. There are changes in everything, but in God, men of high degree are vanity, men of low degree are a lie. Psalm 62:9. We look for more from the creature than God has put in it. It has 2 evils in it. It promises more than we find, and it fails us when we most need it. There is failure everywhere. A man desires to have his corn ground, and the water fails at the mill. The mariner is for a voyage, and the wind does not blow, or is contrary. One depends upon another for the payment of a promise, and he fails, and is like a foot out of joint. Who would look for a fixed stability in the vain creature? It is as if one should build houses on the sand where the sea comes in and overflows. The creature is true to nothing but deceit, and is constant only in its disappointments. It is no more wonderful to see changes fall out here below than to see the moon dressing itself in a new shape and figure. Expect to meet with changes in everything but God. Use 3. Comfort to the godly. First, in the case of losses. If an estate he almost boiled away to nothing, if you lose friends by death, there is a double eclipse. But the comfort is, God is unchangeable. I may lose these things, but I cannot lose my God. He never dies. When the fig tree and olive tree failed, God did not fail. I will joy in the God of my salvation. Habakkuk 3:18. Flowers in the garden die, but a man's portion remains. So outward things die and change, but thou art the strength of my heart and my portion forever. Psalm 73:26. Second, in the case of sadness of spirit, God seems to cast off the soul in desertion, as in Song of Solomon 5:6, my beloved had withdrawn himself. Yet he is unchangeable. He is immutable in his love. He may change his countenance, but not his heart. I have loved thee with an everlasting love. Jeremiah 31:3, Hebrew alam, a love of eternity. If once God's electing love rises upon the soul, it never sets. The mountain shall be removed, but my loving kindness shall not depart from thee, neither the covenant of my peace be removed. Isaiah 54:10. God's love stands faster than the mountains. His love to Christ is unchangeable, and he will no more cease loving believers than he will cease loving Christ. And thus far the reading of Thomas Watson's A Body of Divinity.
This Reformation audio track is a production of Stillwater's Revival Books. You are welcome to make copies and give them to those in need. SWRB makes thousands of classic Reformation resources available, free and for sale, in audio, video, and printed formats. It is likely that the sermon or book that you just listened to is also available on cassette or video, or as a printed book or booklet. Our many free resources, as well as our complete mail order catalog, containing thousands of classic and contemporary Puritan and Reform books, tapes, and videos at great discounts, is on the web at www.swrb.com. We can also be reached by email at swrb@swrb.com, by phone at 780-450-3730, by fax at 780-468-1096, or by mail at 4710-37A Avenue, Edmonton, that's EDMONTON, Alberta, abbreviated capital A, capital B, Canada, T6L3T5. You may also request a free printed catalog. And remember that John Calvin, in defending the Reformation's regulative principle of worship, or what is sometimes called the scriptural law of worship, commenting on the words of God, which I commanded them not, neither came into my heart, from his commentary on Jeremiah 7:31, writes, God here cuts off from men every occasion for making evasions, since he condemns by this one phrase, I have not commanded them, whatever the Jews devised. There is then no other argument needed to condemn superstitions than that they are not commanded by God. For when men allow themselves to worship God according to their own fancies, and attend not to his commands, they pervert true religion. And if this principle was adopted by the papists, all those fictitious modes of worship in which they absurdly exercise themselves would fall to the ground. It is indeed a horrible thing for the papists to seek to discharge their duties towards God by performing their own superstitions. There is an immense number of them, as it is well known, and as it manifestly appears. Were they to admit this principle, that we cannot rightly worship God except by obeying His word, they would be delivered from their deep abyss of error. The prophet's words, then, are very important, when he says that God had commanded no such thing, and that it never came to his mind, as though he had said that men assume too much wisdom when they devise what he never required, nay, what he never knew.